Has your reading taken you to the Mad Hatter's tea party recently? Or have you gone back to classical Greek times and eaten ambrosia? The relationship between food and literature is an old and enduring one.
And most dear actors eat no onions nor garlic, for we are to utter sweet breath, and I do not doubt but to hear them say it is a sweet comedy.
Ravenous, and now very faint, I devoured a spoonful or two of my portion without thinking of its taste. But the first edge of hunger blunted, I perceived I had got in hand a nauseous mess. Burnt porridge is almost as bad as rotten potatoes. Famine itself soon sickens over it. The spoons were moved slowly. I saw each girl taste her food and try to swallow it, but in most cases the effort was soon relinquished. Breakfast was over, and none had breakfasted.
An exquisite scent of olives and oil and juice rose from the great brown dish as Mart, with a little flourish, took the cover off. The cook had spent 3 days over that dish, and she must take great care, Mrs. Ramsay thought, diving into the soft mass, to choose a specially tender piece for William Banks. And she peered into the dish with its shiny walls and its confusion of savoury brown and yellow meats and its bay leaves and its wine.
I like these people. I like their small and introverted concerns. I can read their eyes, their mouths so easily. This one with its hint of bitterness will relish my zesty orange twists. This sweet smiling one, the soft-scented apricot hearts. Caroline Clermont will dream of cinder toffee tonight and wake hungry and irritable. And the children, chocolate curls, white buttons, peanut brittle, sweet harmless temptations to bring down a multitude of saints, crash, crash, crashing amongst the hazels and nougatines.
Chocolat by Joanne Harris, and you also heard extracts there from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, and To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. Well, our love of gastronomy and storytelling is now crossing over into cookbooks, and today the Arvon Foundation, a charity which brings together published and aspiring writers, launches a food writing course to help authors find their culinary voice. Well, we're joined now by Dr. Dimitra Femi, who teaches food in fiction at Cardiff University, and on the line from Edinburgh is the delicatessen owner and author Mary Contini, who was shortlisted for a World Food Book Award for her family biography, Dear Francesca. Dimitra, how has food been used in literature throughout the years? Give us some more examples.
Oh, there's far too many examples. You really don't know where to start. There's, of course, you know, food is used as a sign of realism or sign of life. You have a realistic novel, you will have instances where people will sit down and eat. But, of course, there's many more uses than that. You have characterisation, and probably the best example here is Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And Chaucer isn't that interested about describing the feasts, but he's interested in telling us what each character usually eats.
And what they eat sort of denotes their character.
Exactly. So the Franklin, who's a wealthy and very generous man, we're told about his cellars and his feasts and how, you know, there's abundance of everything and, you know, it snows food in his house. And the prioress is, who's a churchwoman, but at the same time she's probably a little too refined, a little too interested in food to be safe, because she even feeds her dog the very exquisite white bread that people wouldn't usually have at that time. So it's that kind of use.
Symbolism.
Yes, exactly.
But what about children's food then? I mean, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is the most obvious example of food in children's literature. Is food used in the same sort of symbolic way?
Well, food in children's literature is used in a slightly different way. Many times it is didactic. So, for example, you have overweight characters, usually characterised as the baddies. You have, I mean, probably again, yeah, Charlie and Chocolate Factory is a good example. You've got Augustus Gloop.
Terrible things happen to him.
Exactly, punished. And if you think about it, even in the Harry Potter books, Dudley conforms to the same kind of model there. But apart from this kind of, you know, you shouldn't be becoming overweight model, which is quite powerful, there is also the food fantasy situation in children's literature, and especially in the classics. And we're talking about books like The Wind in the Willows and Gerard Tolkien's The Hobbit, and with C.S. Lewis's Narnia stories, where they were written in a period where there was austerity or there was rationing up until the 50s in Britain, really. And at that time, those characters eat a lot of food. And you have lists of, you know, with The Hobbit, you have the dwarfs coming in and all of the cellar of Bilbo Baggins being brought to the table and lists of food after, you know, pickles and chicken and eggs and wine and all sorts of stuff that people wouldn't dream about having such abundance
I'm
at that time.
I'm feeling hungry already. Mary, what role does food play in your books then?
To tell you the truth, it's food that inspires me to write. So when I'm starting to write, I have to say that I have to eat everything in the kitchens first, and then the whole way of
so
life.
Glad you said that.
Well, I think you need energy in your brain as well. But this it's the whole thing that the in our lives, food is really the inspiration for everything that we do. So naturally, when I'm writing, it's food that drives the story in a way.
But food's part of your family history, isn't it? So it's almost inevitable that you'd end up writing about it.
I think so, but the whole thing about the family was that they left an environment where they were raising sheep and they were farmers with a culture of food and religion. And being immigrants coming into another environment, it was food that was the link between the old and the new. And in our lives, that's been the big thing that we've tried to maintain through re-cooking the recipes and writing about them and recording them.
So ties with the past. But, I mean, we've heard examples of how food's been used in literature, but you've kind of come at it the other way round because you've kind of turned from food writer into novelist. Why do you think cookbooks and novels are coming together like this?
I just think it's people are really fascinated about food now, and especially in Britain, there's an undiscovered desire to admit that we actually eat every day. You know, in the past we've been a bit austere about it and not wanted to celebrate it. So I think what I do is share our Italian naturalness about food in my writing. And when I was going to tell the story of our family, just waiting for inspiration to come, it comes from the table. It comes right away, writing about the food.
So in a sense, it's another aspect of the Italian dream, if you like.
Or the Italian not losing the dream, hanging on to the dream. And I'm sure the dream of what they did go through was not exactly as exotic as we make it out to be. But it's all to do with nostalgia and clinging on to routine and their history.
Dimitra, why do you think that food writers write about food again and again and again?
Well, I think the whole idea of giving somebody a recipe is really telling a story, isn't it? And many times you will find yourself given a recipe and either remembering somebody cooking it or imagining you cooking it and try to use, you know, very evocative words to describe it. But at the same time, I think that in the last few decades, we've seen women writing based on recipes for another reason, and that's because we're in a phase of women's writing where women have found their voice and they're celebrating their femininity rather than previous periods where women had just started writing and they were trying to, you know, position themselves in opposition to men.
So do you think there's a real difference then in the way that men and women write about food?
Yes, I think so, because women traditionally are the ones that prepare the food. You know, there is this mother figure model in many you see it in many books and you see it in many situations. I mean, even in modern times where there's a lot of things that you can just pick and microwave, it's still the mother who is responsible for the preparation of food. And also preparing food and consequently writing about it is a way of expressing your creativity.
But food can be quite grotesque in literature as well. I recently read Gautam Malkani's London Stani, and he talks about lots of Indian food there. But it's food that you would like to eat, but he kind of describes it as greasy and fried. And you know that he's having a dig at the parents who can't communicate with the children and are kind of using the food as a way of getting around the fact that they actually don't know what's going on in their children's lives. It can be quite grotesque.
Oh, yes, it can be, definitely. And again, I mean, there is all of this discourse of anorexia in novels as well, and this is really, it's like the characters are trying to control how the family is trying to make them behave. So by making food detestable or grotesque or refusing food, then they're trying to assert their own identities. There's definitely this aspect as well, but most times it's the desire it evokes.
Mary, before you wrote Dear Francesca and Dear Olivia, you wrote cookery books for children. Now, over the summer on Women's Hour, we're looking at the issue of childhood obesity. Do you think teaching children to cook is actually part of the answer to that?
I just think it's a basic instinct of learning the skill of life, and the skill of life is to care for your body and your health. And I've got a huge passion that if only we would teach primary children how to cook, then they could make the correct choices about food. I think food's to do with nourishing your body, and the whole thing about obesity in my analysis is that there's a desire for the nutrients that are not in children's diet at the moment, and that's why they're overeating and becoming obese.
But you come from a tradition of family cooks. That's something that isn't necessarily true for many people.
Well, I think this is a huge problem, that we've got two generations of young people in this country who don't know how to care for their children by cooking for them. So that's why we have to go right in and almost like get the children to teach their parents how to cook. And you know, when I've been into schools, that's the one thing that is fantastic. If you teach children a small recipe, they go back, share it with the parent, and it turns on its head, and all of a sudden the parent is learning from the child.
Yes, I found myself making vegetable soup after my son came home from nursery one day. Anyway, Mary Contini and Dimitra Fimi, thank you very much indeed.